Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. I am your co-host, Chris Seveny. Today, I have a special guest. I have Brian Green from Green Springs Capital Group. Brian, how are you today?
Great, Chris. Thank you for having me.
So I'm going to enjoy this conversation because as we talk real estate and Brian has his own company, it's interesting that when you talk to a lot of people who start their own companies, we all have lives. Brian's a father, married man, got daughters, dogs. We all have normal lives as well. So we'll probably talk a little bit about successes and some of the challenges of that, but also talk about what's going on in real estate and Brian's his niche that he works on, especially working in upstate New York, which you've heard me talk about in the past for what we do in note investing. New York is a very challenging state, but depending on where you are in the state, it's like anything. If you can put a team together and build a niche, you can be very successful. So Brian, again, thanks for joining us. Why don't we start a little bit? Tell us what you got going on today, and then I'll typically hit the rewind button to learn how you got into the business.
Sure, no problem. Thank you, Chris. So today, our company has a portfolio of just over 100 units, all located in upstate New York, as you said. We're specifically located in Saratoga County, which is just south of Lake George and a little bit north of Albany, the state capital. We have 37 units under contract that we're going to be bringing on within the next 2 or 3 weeks. And then we have a ground-up development project, which gets financed through a syndication. And that one is 42 units that we're working through the final phases of approvals with our municipality. And within those figures that I've already provided, we have 15 short-term rentals that we own and operate ourselves. Saratoga is a very big regional tourist hotspot, especially in the summer months. So we're able to kind of capitalize on that influx of population in the summer as well.
So that's awesome. I mean, 100 units. One of the questions I was going to ask when you mentioned Saratoga, I was going to ask why specifically, but someone answered that question of you got the tourist hotspot and, you know, being north of Albany, it seems like it's a good place for people to go. And you also mentioned the ground up construction for this syndication. Is this your first syndication deal?
It is. In the past, we've raised investor capital, but it's always been private notes. We go in with the model of basically redeveloping properties. So it's a little bit more than your traditional value add strategy. When we go in, we're basically converting an entire building from something that was created in the 1960s or 70s with very little upkeep or renovation since then, and going in and basically making it a 2023 product. So when we do that, we're doing a ton of construction work and we're kind of taking it from maybe a C plus all the way up to an A minus type property.
Okay. As a guy who myself have cut my teeth for 25 years in construction, let's go back and see, how'd you get into this business? Because most people who get into it eventually want to get out as fast as possible, but sounds like you're enjoying what you're doing and so forth. But how'd you get into this business?
Yeah, so I do not have a construction background. My background is in finance and marketing. And my first company that I had that I started out of college was a chain of Verizon wireless stores. So I have an operations background, a finance background. So that business I built up from one store up to the most we were at is 23. And then I kind of scaled it back to 15 and ultimately had a successful exit in 2014. Then I got into real estate as a business person, not as a contractor. Started buying small multifamily properties, basically using the BRRRR methodology in buying a distressed property, fixing it up, refinancing it, spinning that same capital into the next project and just kind of stacking one property on top of the other, all the while self-managing, right? Because that operations background, I didn't really know any better, but my thought methodology was I have to manage these myself. I never even thought about third-party management. I just started creating a property management company myself as we kind of scaled up.
Okay. So sounds like lifelong entrepreneur. did the wireless, sold that to get into real estate at the perfect time, right around 2014. So I know I'm down in the DC area in kind of 2012 to 2014, if you got in at that time or even after that, but that was a very good time to get into real estate. I'm guessing it was as well for you. Tell us about kind of your first real estate deal that you did. Was it a little nerve-wracking for you, switching kind of business models to get into real estate?
For me, I don't remember it being that way. It was a small building. It was a 4-unit apartment building. I knew enough to know that I wanted to get in real estate, and I knew how the finances worked, but I didn't really know what I was doing. So I probably slightly overpaid for the property. I purchased it originally with all cash instead of financing it. So I made kind of a bunch of rookie mistakes. I went into the units thinking I was going to start doing the maintenance myself. I even went out and got myself a lawnmower and a snowplow. And
awesome.
You know, I thought I was going to be the stereotypical landlord. I quickly figured out, though, that that game was not for me, and that I started looking through it with the prism of like, all right, if I have 100 units at some point or 500 units, clearly I'm not going to be the guy going around able to mow all the lawns and push the snow around. So I quickly converted into more of a business model where I outsourced all those type of trades. But that's how I got started. I just bought one small building, kind of figured it out as it went along, especially the relationships with tenants. It's not that much different than the customer service element that I had in retail before that when I was dealing with a lot of customers. So it kind of had that kind of synchronization as I moved into real estate.
So a two-part question that I was going to ask is, as you got going into real estate, you mentioned that a lot of your earlier deals, you did private notes with investors. Why the private notes over just getting a traditional bank lending?
So we do both. So we use, okay, and we still do it to this day on many projects that we get into. So our normal model is we'll get 75 to 80% loan to cost of the purchase and the renovation. So most of our bank lending on the front end is with local banks, and it's a construction loan. Then you still have that 20% delta there where we'd either have to come out of pocket with equity, or we raise a portion of that from private individuals on notes that we can repay when construction's finished, because our bank lending always is built into auto convert to a long-term mortgage at the stabilized value. So we're buying properties with the methodology that we're going to be able to fix them up, refinance out, return all the investors' note capital, and then we ultimately end up with a brand new building fully leased out with high paying tenants, and we have zero of our own capital in the deal. We just have that equity bump that we just created.
And how many of the investors that did private notes for you are now investing in your syndication?
All of them.
So that
which is a little strange because it's a different, I mean, if you're in notes, then it's a different classification of investor generally. Maybe not. I mean, usually I'm seeing a different demographic age-wise. Some of our older investors, they prefer the note route because it's guaranteed and it's, they can plan for it. Whereas younger investors always want the equity and the upside, but they all kind of converted from notes into the equity opportunity we have currently.
Yeah. The reason I wanted to bring that up is for people listening, whether you're an active or passive investor, just realize Brian clearly was in this for the long game. And by getting investors on early on, even on one-off deals, you start building a relationship with people. And as those relationships grow, they have friends who have friends that continue to invest. And now he's got this new development that he's raising capital for, that he's got already investors coming in the door, which in today's environment, today's not the easiest time to raise money, especially probably for a ground up construction, because there's a lot of posts and things online out there about some concerns with multifamily or these types of deals. But like any business, there's good deals and there's not so good deals. And it really boils down to the sponsor and understanding what they have to do. Would you agree with that?
I would completely. I mean, the deal matters. And there's always, I mean, especially like you said, with the ground up development, and it's our first time syndicating, there's some trepidation there by investors that aren't familiar with our company. But in the end, everyone that funded their investment, they're doing so because they trust me, they trust my brother, who's my partner, they trust us as a company, and they know our track record, which is way more important than the actual nuts and bolts of the deal we're executing on. Because you could have the greatest deal ever, and if the operator doesn't know what they're doing, that project's not going to go very well. And on the flip side, if you have an experienced operator like us, even a marginal deal, we can make pretty great, because there's a lot of levers you can pull along the way. And if you're managing it properly, I think you can turn those kind of maybe on paper average deals into home runs in the end through operation.
Yeah, somebody made an interesting comment once about using real estate analogy to be like pilot flying a plane. Anytime you're up in the air, you want to experience somebody, a pilot up there who knows what they are doing, not somebody who just read a book yesterday and then all of a sudden realizes they're syndicating. And actually, I had someone call me the other day. So again, we primarily invest in mortgage notes, and the person called me asking about they wanted to start a fund. And I said, okay. And I'm like, have you bought notes before? He goes, no, can you teach me how to buy notes? And I'm like, you're trying to start a fund in something you have no idea? I'm like, yeah, I'm sorry. Politely, I don't have time to talk about this right now. But yeah. So you mentioned a moment ago, you're also business partners, your brother. So how is that? And again, this is being recorded, but no, we joke because I love my siblings, but I would never go to business with them. But how's working with your brother?
I would say that it's great. And it's also challenging at times. Just unlike normal business partners, that when they have disagreements or ultimately they could kind of, maybe they split up and they go their own ways. But when it's your brother or your family, you kind of are forced to work through those issues. Now, I'm not somebody that shies away from direct confrontation, probably to a fault sometimes, because my brother's very much the opposite of that. But I think us being brothers works really well, especially since he's very different than I am personality-wise. But I constantly force those difficult conversations on the front end, which makes things uncomfortable. But I think in the end, we have a better result because we kind of work through it.
Yeah, there's going to be hard conversations, but it's better to have them earlier than later and then let it boil up and steam over to other things. So talk a little bit about the ground up. And I know your mission is looking to try and provide properties that are in very good condition at attainable prices. And it seems like based on the success you've had, you've got a very good track record of that. What would you say has been kind of, you don't have to say your secret sauce, but what is one of your differentiators of how you've been able to be successful? Because that is a challenge that a lot of people try to provide, is managing, especially when you have investors, you're trying to manage, hey, I need to make money, but also make sure I keep it occupied and that fine balance and keep it in good condition. So you have low maintenance. How's that balancing act been?
So I think a lot of it starts on the front end, which educating ourselves on the business, on construction, on how to buy, on underwriting. I think we're fairly conservative in our underwriting compared to most. I'm pretty much of the mindset where I won't even look at a property unless it makes sense on paper, so that I don't have that kind of emotional reaction to it or start trying to force the numbers as we all have before. You get that spreadsheet in front of you. And it's amazing. I've dealt with bankers before who joke that they've never seen a pro forma that wasn't correct. So you start playing the spreadsheet game. So I think that on the front end, we buy right, we make sure we have cushion on our construction budget, and we're conservative in our future rent projections. And that allows us to finish projects out, making them, like you said, like new, to make sure we can do everything on the front end and still have that product in the back end where an attainable rental amount is possible and still checks all of our boxes for returns. Because in the end, it's still a business. We're still trying to hit certain metrics. We just want to do it in a way where we have a product that we're proud of and that we can present to residents and in some way keep it, like I use the word attainable because affordable is kind of the word people use for government-backed housing.
Yeah,
we're not doing that, but we're also not creating A-plus space. So that, I guess the way to look at it is, in our market, even for our new development, we're pricing out apartments at $2,600 a month. That's a two-bedroom, two-bath, brand-new apartment.
How many square feet on average?
Yeah, they're about 1,200. So pretty.
So, yeah, 220 a square foot, roughly. So
pretty decent size. But there's other new developments in our market that same apartment might cost $3,200 or $3,300. So we're trying to kind of exist in that B-plus to A-minus space. I think it has less volatility of that space. And you don't kind of get that compression when maybe the economy goes south, where those A-plus type renters start dropping down to the A-minuses and B-pluses. You're still high enough where you have a tenant base that's high quality. And I like to joke that you want tenants that are concerned with their credit score. So we're still in that space. It's kind of like that young professional is kind of our resident avatar.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of Creating Wealth Simplified. We wanted to take a moment and tell you more about our passive income fund at 7E, which is open to both accredited and non-accredited investors. Our latest offering targets an 8% annual return distributed monthly, with the ability to potentially achieve a greater return through our bonus share program. If you'd like more information, reach out to us at invest@70investments.com to learn more. Thank you. It's interesting because I've worked in a multifamily space for a long time and see a lot of people who like to own or operate that trophy property, which it's great to have your name on it and own it and have all the amenities and everything that goes along with it. But the moment that economy starts to soften and then you have to start dropping rates and all of a sudden your pro forma is based off of $3,200 bucks a month. And now you got to go down to $2,700, $2,800. And typically most operators basically refuse to try and get down there to force it because the numbers don't work at that. And then that's where and get themselves in trouble. And people go to renew the lease and they're like, no, we're not budging. And next thing you know, guess where they're at? They're over at Brian's place, you know, renting from you. So I've seen that happen a lot. So with those rental units and so forth, do you still have your own property management company as well?
We do. We still manage all of our own buildings. And we actually just started managing third party for other investors, but only if it's a short-term rental. So we do that only because we have a skill set internally with our management team to handle that type of asset. We have 15 of our own, and the revenue potential on a short-term management agreement is much greater than a long-term.
Yeah.
So at that point, it's worth our time and energy to do so, but we're very selective in how we do that.
You mentioned something that I kind of was, people watch on video, I was kind of crackling at when you mentioned, you know, the pro formas. And again, I'm an investor as well, and I'll look at a pro forma, and it is the rosiest of roses where every star and planet has to align for what somebody puts on paper. And you also mentioned the other component of looking at it without arbitrarily, because I don't care who you are, if you're a real estate investor, there is some point in time where you tried to force those numbers. It's just, you just have tried to, the deal just doesn't pencil. And then you're like, okay, well, maybe I get a little more aggressive here, aggressive there. But I would tell people, don't. You really got to stick to your guns, be more conservative because it gives you a little more float. And that kind of was going to lead my next question. Like, the assets do you buy? Are they basically tired landlords or landlords that have failed to operate properly, a mix of both? Where do you find a lot of your product?
It's a mix of both, just due to the nature of the product we're looking for, in that we usually force value through construction. We find ourselves buying properties where, you know, the landlords could be, usually they're local landlords. They're not very sophisticated. They're still operating good properties. What I find though, oftentimes, is they are not reinvesting in CapEx expenditures. Yeah. So they might be fixing things that need to be fixed, but that can only get you so far. If the place was built 40, 50 years ago and you don't ever replace the kitchens or bathrooms, like at some point, the building is just tired and worn and it automatically becomes a C-minus building, even if you're doing your best efforts to maintain the tenant base. You're just going to get a deterioration of the residents. You're going to get a deterioration of the timeliness of those rent payments. And at some point, a company like us has to come in and kind of rip the Band-Aid off and do massive renovations to kind of bring that asset up to this year's kind of standards, I would say.
Yeah, I used to look at some smaller multifamily and very similar challenges I've always found is go look at it and then, okay, you need to put the new windows in. Exterior needs a lot of maintenance. Heating needs to be redone. Some of them need new roofs. Everything that need to be done that doesn't bring in an extra penny basically need to be done. People put in, hey, we'll go throw a new floor and we'll paint the inside. You know, we'll put the lipstick on the pig, but anything of substance doesn't get done. And that's a great opportunity also for somebody who's looking to buy where you can get in and really probably pick something up that is a little distressed to fix it up to also push the rents a little bit as well. So,
yeah. And that kind of, to your point before about how we buy and how we're trying to provide attainable rents. Also internally, we're trying to make sure that we have enough cushion so that we can make all those improvements you just mentioned, because we don't want to manage an asset that has a 25-year-old HVAC system or needs a new roof. So we're going to go in and make sure we do all that stuff on the front end. And oftentimes we're talking to brokers about acquisition opportunities and they're like, oh, it just needs paint and flooring and you can increase the rents by $100 a month. And sometimes that's true. Most of the times it's not. But my rebuttal to that is always, yeah, great. I can do that and I can achieve the rents, but the roof is still 30 years old and the HVAC is still worn and tired. So like, when am I going to replace that? And they never want to factor that in because, as you said, it doesn't really affect the rental rate to a great degree, but it's stuff that has to be done. And if it's not being done, like somebody has to pay for that.
Switching topics a little bit. One of, I know, the challenges recently in the space also has been getting bank financing with your acquisitions. And you sticking in one market, I'm guessing you probably have one or very select lenders you go to as well and have relationships with. Have they changed any of their standards for lending?
Yes. Actually, we primarily were using one local credit union. We like credit unions a lot because they charge very little in fees and there's no prepayment penalty when you exit. as we always do when the building's stabilized and we try to refinance it. But coincidentally, also, that bank was just merged with another credit union. So now the management team is all different. So that all happened within the last 6 months. So back in May, we actually brought on a former commercial mortgage broker, and he's doing a heightened finance role for us where he's working almost like a fractional amount, and he's overseeing all of our books, but mostly he's sourcing all of our debt now. And he has relationships with every single bank in the market because he was a commercial brokerage, our broker for 5 to 10 years. So he's getting us financing now on some of our deals that I never would have been able to get on my own before, just through his relationships. So I think right now, given to what you said about how hard it's getting to get financing, having him on board and bringing him on in May was like the best thing we possibly could have done as a company.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, because something that never popped in my head that people seeking who have volume trying to find new relationships and get new funding, because again, funding sources come and go and could dry up. Having somebody who's got all that experience and that network and connections is, I'm sure, very pivotal and key, because it also probably is providing you some additional deals that other people might not, or might struggle to try and find financing, especially if a lot of people are going to that one credit union.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to give you an example of that, we're working through final stages of financing and sourcing is competing term letters for our ground up development now that we're just about approved through the municipality. And one of the terms GC's sourcing is like a consortium of three local banks that he kind of put together on his own. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I would have even thought to do that, but it's three local banks that have maxed out at like maybe a $3 to $5 million loan. Yep. And he was able to get them all together. And now they're kind of working in tandem, and they might actually be the most competitive term sheet that we get. And I never would have the time, resources, or connections to kind of put that thing together.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was at a conference last week regarding, it was a bank special assets where bank has distress assets and properties and stuff. And that's what the things they were talking about were these participation loans. And I kind of heard of them, but never really thought about them, where it's exactly what you said, where several different lenders will come together and kind of nobody wants to give the entire deal. Each one will want to take a piece either based on size or risk. One of them will still take the lead, but they've got other banks participating. And depending on a lot of those deals, if you can make it work, you're right. People have said they get much better term sheets on those types of deals because it's also a little less risk for those banks. And in today's interest rate environment, every quarter point or eighth point counts. So,
yes, absolutely. And I'm glad that I'm not the only one that had never heard of that type of lending scenario before.
And that's our primary business. I mean, we buy debt, and so we do some private lending and stuff. But you know, it's interesting, some of the creative ways and things that can be done out there in this space. So as we get to wrap up this episode, I like to ask people kind of one question of, what do you believe has been one of your biggest factors for the success that you've had to date in the business? Is there one thing that kind of, or several things that stick out that you think has led to the success of your company?
I think that to a great degree, it's self-education on my part and just kind of absorbing every and all piece of information I can possibly find that has to do with real estate, investing, landlording. Back when I started in real estate, I was not necessarily an avid reader. I mean, I would read here and there, but nothing seriously. Now, and since then, maybe for the last 8 years, I've listened to thousands of podcasts and read hundreds of books. I mean, I think I've read every single book on real estate that is available. But I think that it's critical to do that, because when you're reading the information or listening to a podcast like this one, you might listen to it and be like, oh, that's informative, but there's no real takeaway. But then 6 months from now, I could be looking at a deal and something will click that I read or that I heard before. And I'm like, oh my God, I can use that right now. And this makes all the sense in the world. And this is going to secure the deal, or this is going to make or break the transaction. Or this is going to help me hire this key person, or it's helping me hire my finance guy when maybe 2 months before I needed him, just because I had that in the back of my mind that I was going to need him at some point. So I think the education piece is huge, especially if you're going to go into this where you're going to eventually turn into the syndication or raising a fund, and you're going to go out and try to extend your credibility to raise capital from limited partners. I think you're doing yourself a disservice and your limited partners if you're not engrossing yourself in every piece of information that you can find on the subject matter. That doesn't mean you want to get into that analysis paralysis phase, but it does mean that you need to be self-aware to know that you don't know everything, and that you constantly have to keep that education wheel rolling so that you're putting yourself and your limited partners in the best position you can.
Interesting you mentioned that, because I was very similar I was an avid reader until I kind of started doing my own more entrepreneurial things. And I'd read a book. It's like, okay, good book, take some notes on it and so forth. And then a lot of times when you're reading some of this stuff, you don't also know what you don't know, or you don't know what some of the key takeaways are, but you remember certain things. And all of a sudden something will come up today and I'll be like, oh, I remember I read a book. Like, which book was it that commented on this? Or I can go back and look at it, or the situation where this something happened, and basically like, oh, here it is. And especially as you grow a business, and like you have, when you go from, you know, single deals up to syndications, like you may have read a syndication book 5 years ago and it's like, great, I kind of know what a syndication is. But all of a sudden, once you start putting one together, you go back to some of the things that you looked at the past, or and really kind of re-educate yourself. And that's so important for people. I agree 100% with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Brian, if people want to reach out, learn more about you, your projects, your syndications, or what you got going on in general, what's the best way for people to reach out to you?
Our company's pretty active on Instagram, so they can reach us at Green Springs Capital, or they can send me a direct email, brian@greenspringscapitalgroup.com. Always happy to talk real estate, investing, whatever. I'm kind of engrossed in this business like most of us are, so I've got no problem talking real estate for hours on end. So just send me a message and we'll connect.
Great. And one last question, just that more curiosity of me. Where do you see yourself taking your business in 5 years?
So we have this pretty well mapped out. We run on EOS.
Okay. You're an EOS person as well. So
So
are you level 10 meetings and everything going?
Yeah, that's right. A lot of them. So our 10-year goal that we set up about almost 2 years ago was to get to 1,000 apartment or rental units, we term them, because it could include mobile home parks at some point, but definitely rental units. 1,000 of those, which in our market will equate to somewhere between 200 million and 250 million in total property value under our assets under management. And to get there, we know that we need to buy 35 to 70 established apartments that we could redevelop every year. And we want to start a new ground up development each and every year as well. And we kind of layer those on top of each other. And then if we do that in 8 years, we'll be at our goal.
Nice. You definitely got that all mapped out and planned out as well. Yeah. And our goal is eventually same thing, around 200 to 250 million. And we look at that as kind of a nice sweet spot to be in, where you're not managing, well, you have a property management company, so that's a little bit different. But our goal is we never wanted to manage 100. I never want to manage 100 people and then just speak up from that standpoint. But that is great. So Brian, thanks for joining us today on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. People listening, make sure to check out their Instagram, what they've got going on, and all that information will also be in the show notes. So Brian, again, thanks for joining us today and enjoy the rest of your week.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.